Blog Talk Radio.
Strive not to be a success, but rather to be of value. Albert Einstein said that. Now it's time for some value on the Goldstein on Geld Show.
You're listening to the Goldstein on Geld Show with financial expert Douglas Goldstein. This show is designed to give general information related to investing and finance. Neither Doug Goldstein, his guests, nor the radio station are rendering legal, tax, insurance, or specific financial advice. If you require such advice, contact a competent professional advisor. Before making any investment decisions based on what you heard during the show, please review the complete disclaimer located at www.goldsteinongeld.com. And now, here's your host, money maven Doug Goldstein.
Good Money Monday. I'm Doug Goldstein. Thanks so much for joining me today. I've got two fantastic guests, both of whom are ultra super best-selling authors. I'll tell you all about that in a minute, but I want to tell you about a conversation I had recently with a client. One of my clients likes picking stocks. He's got a few, basically maybe 10, 15 companies in his portfolio. Some of them are very, very major positions. Some of them are minor positions. And he said to me, Doug, what stocks are you picking for your clients for the year 2015? And I said, that's a great question, because I don't actually believe that people should be picking stocks. He said, yeah, but I've done so well in my portfolio. I said, first off, maybe you are either very smart, which is no problem, and I compared him to potentially Warren Buffett, although he didn't have the billions of dollars. The other possibility is you're lucky, right, which does happen to some people. And another possibility is that because the portfolio was so non-diversified, what do I mean by that? I could make a reasonable argument that owning 10 to 20 stocks is fairly diversified, but if one of those companies or two of those companies represents more than half your portfolio, are you really diversified? And then when you say, look how well I've done, is the risk-reward ratio really accurate? Do you even know how to judge such a thing? Most mutual fund managers will broadly diversify their portfolio, so they wouldn't ever have the chance of beating someone who, let's say, puts half his money in one stock if that one stock does well. But the question is that a wise way for a normal person to invest his, let's say, to invest his retirement savings? So I'm a big fan of being lucky. If you can do it, that's awesome. But as an advisor, and I have to watch out for lots and lots of people, I'm much more inclined to tell someone, let's diversify the portfolio, let's use exchange-traded funds or mutual funds or money managers, some sort of tool to try to pull the emotion out of the investing and to try to diversify more broadly. But I do freely admit that there are always opportunities that we're going to miss simply because we're not willing to take those sort of chances. Let's say that we thought we found a great bank to invest in. It's been around for 160 years, and they've got a great name and a huge client base. And then it turned out that we had put all of our money into buying shares of Lehman Brothers before they went bust in 2007, or before the government let them go bust, before it was the habit of the government to bail out banks. I'm not saying it was a good investment then or not. The point is, it would be a perfectly reasonable thing for someone to say, well, it's an established bank, it's been around forever, and therefore I put a lot of money there. I don't really think that's the way to go. So let's talk more about that in a minute, and I will also tell you about today's fantastic guests on the Goldstein on Geld Show. Now let's hear from CPA Ron Zalbin with a tax tip on the Goldstein on Geld Show.
Hi, I'm Ron Zalbin with the U.S. and Israeli CPA firm of Avu Lafia Avital and Sharansky in Jerusalem. In today's segment, I'd like to give you a tip of how to save interest and linkage on your Israeli taxes and also interest on your American taxes. If you expect that you will owe tax for tax year 2014 in Israel, that interest starts accruing as of January 1st. Of 2015. However, if you make an estimated payment before January 31st of 2015, that payment is deemed to be paid as if it was paid as of January 1st, 2015, meaning that it will cut off any interest or linkage that may accrue. If you pay in by February 28th of 2015, you will cut off 50% of the interest and the linkage from January 1st through February 28th. If you pay by March 31st, you will cut off 25% of the linkage and interest between January 1st and March 31st. We advise clients that they should do calculations in order to minimize their exposure to interest and linkage. In the United States, if you owe tax for tax year 2014. That tax starts accruing interest as of April 15th of 2015. We therefore advise clients also to do projections for American tax purposes in order to cut off any interest that they may incur. And last, if you have real estate income from residential rental property in Israel for tax year 2014, in order to take advantage of the 10% tax on gross rent, so let's say you had 10,000 shekels of rental income, you would pay 1,000 shekels of tax. You need to pay this in by January 31st of 2015. If you do not pay in by that date, that rental income will be subject to regular tax rates in Israel, which can be as high as 50%. If any of these cases apply to you, I suggest you consult with a qualified tax advisor. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to email me at ron@abulafia.co.il.
Thanks so much, CPA Ron Zalbin, for today's Goldstein on Gelf tax tip.
American Olim, watch out. Even if you don't owe taxes to America, if you don't file the right forms, you could get fined. Did you file your FBAR? Do you understand FATCA? Learn how to manage your U.S. investments from overseas and the tax and reporting requirements for American expatriates in the new book by Doug Goldstein. www.expatguidetomoney.com. Get the book and get in compliance with the IRS.
Okay, we are back. I'm very happy to have on the Goldstein on Gelt show Mike Bacalowicz, who by his 35th birthday had already started and sold two multi-million dollar companies. And then with all of the genius he had learned, he actually became an angel investor and proceeded then to lose his entire fortune. So we're going to learn a lot from Mike today, who subsequently became an Uber best-selling author with three fabulous books. Mike, a real pleasure to have you.
Oh, man, it's great to be here. Thanks, Doug.
So apart from the fact that you've got some interesting books and interesting ideas, you've also got great titles for your books, which I really like The Pumpkin Plan and The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur. And I hope we're going to get to talk about all of them. But your most recent book is called Profit First Formula. Can you tell us what the overall theme is of that?
Yeah, so I believe a lot of entrepreneurs get addicted to axioms, meaning we perceive these certain truths in business because it's always been this way. We used to believe the world is flat. Mankind did. And so everyone would say, keep your boat in the harbor. Don't go out too far. You'll fall off the edge. Well, in business, the formula for profit is sales minus expenses equals profit. That's the axiom that's out there. And it's wrong. It's flawed. Logically it makes sense, but behaviorally it's totally wrong. Because what happens is we make our sales, the money comes into our bank account, we then do the next step is we pay expenses. So we look at our bank account and pay expenses, deplete in the account, and profit is a leftover. What I suggest in Profit First is simply flip the formula. So sales minus profit equals expenses. And what happens in this scenario is you sell as much as you can, as you always would, but you first subtract a predetermined percentage, 5, 10, 15% of those sales stored away as profit. Now the remainder is for expenses. And it's a very minor shift, but the consequences are profound. By giving ourselves less money for expenses, by seeing less money in our bank account, behaviorally we adjust to make our business run more frugally. So it's a subtle change. It's the pay yourself first mentality applied in our personal life, now applied to business.
I think it's a great idea. And a lot of times people ask me, why do I have such an eclectic group of guests on the Goldstein on Gelt show, from chess players to comedians to entrepreneurs? Because this is really a personal finance show. And we've had great entrepreneurs like Mike Michalowicz and Michael E. Gerber, right? The king of the E-myth. And I'm very interested in this because I believe that managing a business is very, very much like managing your home finances. So the profit principle that you're describing, do you think that would apply also in someone's savings and personal finance?
Yeah, no question about it. And in fact, that's where I stole the concept from. pay yourself first, that mentality. The reason they tells us to do it in our personal lives is that our lifestyle adjusts to our net income. One of the greatest savings mechanisms of all time is a pay-yourself-first principle. In the U.S., it's the 401k. And every country has its own version of this. But basically, the employer pays you your gross pay, say it's $1,000 for that period. They subtract then out your tax liabilities and your retirement, your 401k first. Then we get paid the residual. Maybe it's $600. Very quickly, we adjust our lifestyle to live off that residual check. Well, that's the pay yourself first mentality applied to business. Behind the scenes, that retirement money that's been taken away, piles up very quickly, and more people have achieved millions of savings through a 401k than any other mechanism. So this principle absolutely applies to our personal lifestyle, and what I just implore now is that we need to apply as entrepreneurs to our own business too.
Right. You know, exactly what you're describing is what I've seen in my own day job. In real life, I'm a financial advisor, so I meet with people doing their financial plans, and we look at their budgets and their investment portfolios. And sometimes I'll find a family that lives on $30,000 a year and is saving, and I'll find other with five or six or seven kids, and I'll find another family where they earn $300,000 a year, but they're so deep in debt they can't even pay off on a month-to-month basis.
It's shocking. It's check by check. There was a study of U.S.-based businesses. There's 28 million small businesses in the U.S., and this is defined by having $25 million in revenue or less. Of these 28 million businesses, 22 million are running check by check. Just in that circumstance, you said that all this income may be flowing into the business, but it's flowing out just as fast. And if they don't get another deposit in the next week or two, it literally can put them out of business. So it is the natural tendency of entrepreneurs, and I believe all people, to expand our lifestyle to meet the money that's coming in. So instead of trying to willpower ourselves into savings, I'm suggesting make it a mechanism, an automatic mechanism. And then our behavior becomes our best ally, because it's an automatic mechanism. This money's be taken away and put aside. We now naturally adjust to the net income that we have, and we still may live check by check, but because the money's been taken out in advance, there's a savings happening behind the scene.
And that's what's critical. We're talking with best-selling author Mike Michalowicz, who wrote, among other books, Profit First Formula, and he also wrote The Pumpkin Plan and The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur, which I guess, Mike, that was your first book. And one of the things I liked about the fact that you wrote a book called The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur was that I'm always looking for ways, like you, of trying to learn a lesson about money or investing or business from something else. In fact, I just came out with a book about how the strategies of chess can be applied to investing.
Yeah.
And I actually partnered up with a world chess champion, a woman named Susan Polgar, and she and I had a similar conversation like you and I are having about how certain ideas from her field could be applied to managing your own money. And after many, many hours of talking and a lot of research, we eventually wrote it up. But let's cut to your book on the Toilet Paper Entrepreneur. And you've got this philosophy there that it's better for someone to start a business with fewer resources.
Right.
Why is that?
Because necessity is the mother of invention. And a lot of entrepreneurs I see are going into business seeing the stories of Google or whoever the company is that got funded and it became a success. And then it's now this belief that if I want to be successful, I need to accumulate a lot of money. But the funny thing about money, especially other people's money, is that it dumbs down our senses. And when we have a problem or something's not working, money kind of carries us or bridges us over that problem, and we can continue on our business. It's the fact is, when we have no money, any mistake we make, any problem we have in our business, we are acutely aware of it. It is painful to spend the last few dollars I have and it's not working. So it actually makes our senses hypersensitive to challenges and allows us to adjust quickly. So it makes us very aware of the ongoing action and activities in our business. But secondarily, when my competitor has thousands or millions of dollars to throw at a situation and I have nothing, it forces me to find ways to get the same thing done without money. But the less resources that an entrepreneur has, the more innovative they become, and it's the most innovative entrepreneurs that are ultimately the most successful.
You know, and I think that applies exactly. You know, we see this real problem with young people when they finish school, and then they expect money, right? They expect to go get a high-paying job, which they don't get, and then they end up going and living on their parents, in the parents' basement for years and years because they don't have the necessity. There is no – the only mother they have around is their mom cooking and doing their cleaning for them. So they don't get any better at handling money.
Yeah, I think it's tough. So I'm a parent of three children. I have one actually going to college now. And, you know, there's this protective mechanism. You know, I want to support my kids. I want to give them the best life ever. But, you know, what I'm finding is the best life ever is to allow them to face the challenges of life. Protect them. Don't let them get totally – don't let it kill them, but let them get burned a little bit. Let them fight their own way. Because once you survive the struggles of life, you realize that there's opportunity in the struggle. You're not the only one facing that problem. Everyone else is. But if you're the one willing to work through it and find a way around it, that will put you ahead. So I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. In fact, I'm just thinking, I had a meeting with this woman who came in. She was in her late 50s, and she was complaining about how her kids were living at home. And in fact, she was doing their laundry and cooking and cleaning for them. And I said, well, okay, stop, you know, just tell them they have 3 months to find a place. And she said, no, I can't do that. So I said, oh, are they disabled? And she goes, no, they're totally fine. They finished school. I said, so why can't you just tell them they have to move on? She said, well, first I want to teach them to be independent, and then I'll let them go. And I
Isn't thought, that fun? Yeah, there you go.
How are you going to teach them that?
Well, I'll tell you, they are disabled. Their confidence is disabled, and it's a horrible cycle. But see, so the funny thing is, bringing this back to business, it translates the same way. A business that gets funded, it's basically a parent, say a corporation or a wealthy angel investor, that comes in as a parent and gives money to this business. And now the business says everything's all right. No, you haven't
so
lived
the next round, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there's businesses out there that do this, Doug. They just constantly are trying to raise funds, and they never get out of the coop. They never fly from the nest.
Yeah, I always wonder who. It's funny. I have a client who he's very successful at this. And whenever I say how's business going, the only thing he talks to me is about the rounds of investment. He never tells me about what they're developing.
My God.
And you know, I never thought of it exactly. It always sort of bugged me. I'm thinking, who are the guys he's suckering in to give him all this money? But
as an investor, I would run away from that. I got burned on it. You mentioned I was an angel investor. I call myself the angel of death because it was really not an area I should be in. I was very bad at it. But I did learn one valuable lesson, that the more I funded a business, the more I became dependent and focused on getting more funds, and the business was simply the business of raising money. It wasn't the business of getting something done and impacting the world. Those are the worst investments out there.
Yeah, I think that applies, like we said, also with your kids, when you just completely throw money at them and don't let them get any better. It also applies to charities. I had another client who was a huge, huge donor to their synagogue. They were it. And then one day they got in a fight and they said, yeah, I'm not going to donate anymore. The synagogue said, wait, but that's it. We have no other money but you. And the donor walked away. And, you know, this must be about 10 years ago. And what do you know? The people in the synagogue, they managed to turn things around.
And they
figured it out in the end. So I think that really helps.
Yeah.
Mike, I want to ask you one more quick question because I had so many things, but we're just about out of time. In Profit First, you focus on four methods, which are really referred to, or they're based on healthy lifestyle habits. And I'd like you just to summarize the four. I don't know if we're going to have time to, we certainly won't have time to talk about all four, but just to give us a sense of how you made that connection and maybe something we could take away.
Sure. Okay. So there's four kind of healthy lifestyle habits. The first one is, if you want to live a healthy lifestyle, get smaller plates for your house. So this is a behavioral principle. The plates in the global diet has expanded. If you rewind 200 years ago, plates were half the size they are today. And the natural tendency is fill up the plate, eat what's on it. So by reducing the plates, our behavior gets to continue to be the same, but the guardrails are in place now to actually consume less calories. Well, in our business, most of us have one account or two accounts for our business. It's one big plate. I suggest that businesses have five or six accounts for different purposes, one for profit, one for paying the owners, one for expenses, one for tax liabilities. And by saying all these different plates, as money comes in, you allocate it to these plates, and now you're consuming less. Instead of eating off of one big tray and thinking it's all available for expenses, by divvying up to smaller plates, you know it's truly available for what purpose, and you'll automatically become more prudent in how you use your money. Second step is vegetables first. The sequence we eat food is very important. If you eat your vegetables first, you get the nutrients you need right up front, and you're likely to eat less later on. In business, the first thing we need to do is take our profit. It's the last thing we do. The nutrients come last. When money comes in, the first thing is allocate that money to your profit. Then with the rest, see what you can do in allocating it elsewhere. But if you take care of your profit first, you're getting the most important nutrients your business can get.
All right, Mike, I'm going to stop you there because, first of all, I know because I've already read it. Number three and four are critical both to entrepreneurs as well as to people handling their own finances, and I'm going to encourage everyone to go out and buy the book Profit First. But, Mike, we're just about out of time, so
tell me,
the last few seconds, just tell us how can people follow your work, and get some of the great free resources that you offer.
Go to MikeMichalowicz.com, and if you sign up, I used to write for the Wall Street Journal. You can get free articles, and if you navigate the site, I blog every single day, and I have free book downloads for all my books on MikeMichalowicz.com.
All right, and it's fantastic, I will tell you there, and we will put a link to that at the show notes of today's show of Goldstein on Gelt. Mike, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Find out about Doug's favorite online investment resources, most of which are free, by signing up at the website for the fascinating book that he's written with world chess champion Susan Polgar, Rich as a King, How the Strategies of Chess Can Make You a Grandmaster of Investing. Check it out and get the free Grandmaster's Toolbox at richasaking.com.
In the opening of the show, I told you about some conversations I had with clients where they were anxious to be stock pickers. And I think you have to ask your question, is it better to invest in individual stocks or, let's say, to buy an exchange-traded fund or a mutual fund? For those of you who are longtime listeners, you know that I'm not a big fan of people trading their own portfolios because I think ultimately they usually do a pretty poor job, and statistically the studies have shown they do. There will always be the black swans who successfully do manage it, but let's look at a time when maybe it does pay to invest in an individual stock. In some industries, there could be a very, very wide dispersion of returns. Let's say high tech. Some companies are going to do fantastic. Some companies are going to do really poorly. If you are a very astute stock picker and you can do great research and add value, then I really do think you might be able to find the companies in a specific sector which will do better than others. Other sectors don't really lend themselves to this. I think you might look at maybe a slower kind of sector like a utility company, right? Is one utility company going to be so dramatically different from the other? If you want to own utility companies, maybe that's an area to buy an exchange-traded fund or some type of fund where you own a broadly diversified portfolio. So the conclusion is, I don't really believe people should be picking individual stocks, but if you're going to, make sure you're doing it in an area where you, doing your research, can add a lot of value to the bottom line. All right, stay tuned. We're just about going to have to wrap up now with part one. Stay tuned for part two. I'll be bringing on a number one New York Times best-selling author, David Bach, to talk about some very, very important money-making strategies.
You're listening to Money Maven Doug Goldstein on the Goldstein on Gelt Show. Stay tuned for the second half of the show right after the break.